Hi, I'm Christy Uden, CEO at the Board of Certified Safety Professionals. When you think of a safety professional, what comes to mind? Maybe someone holding a clipboard, telling their coworkers what they're doing wrong? That image is common, but narrowly characterizes the fundamental role of a safety professional. Safety professionals play a critical role in the company's culture, making it a place where people want to work. They help us see the impact of the safe workplace and think of safety as something we want, not just something we need. Join me as we take a dive into the many facets of what safety professionals really do and the impact they have for their organizations. This is Safety on Location.
All right. Well, we would like to welcome all of our listeners back for another episode of Safety on Location. I'm Charlie, and I'm joined by Christy Uden, our CEO. Christy, how's it going today?
It is going well. Thanks for asking. How about you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm excited to bring this episode to our listeners because this is, to date, probably the most wild environment we've been to. And I say that jokingly because we went to the St. Louis Zoo. So it was one of the more unique places that we visited for this series. And we had a really good time just learning about what safety and health means at the zoo.
Yeah, it was a great learning experience. And I just enjoy going to some of these unique locations. And in fact, almost everything's been unique to some degree because, you know, everybody has a story. And so it's great to hear their story.
Yeah. And so we met with Dominique Montgomery, who's their director of safety and risk management at the St. Louis Zoo. And it was a really great conversation with her. Christy, before we jump into the episode, is there anything that kind of stood out to you that you want to prep our listeners for?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really stood out to me during our visit was that strong bond between the workers and the animals that they care for. And really, that connection was a powerful reminder of why compassion, care, mental health matter so much, not just in our professional lives, but in all of the relationships that we nurture. And so whether it be people, animals, those emotional connections can really impact and affect our moods and behaviors.
Yeah.
So isn't it that connection I thought, you know, really stood out and made me think about, you know, how it correlates with human to human experiences as well.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, we dive into that and talk about a lot of other things. And again, this is just, I think, going to be an eye-opening experience. A lot of people, when they visit a zoo, don't think about what goes on behind the scenes to make sure that the visitors, the employees, the animals are all kept safe. So we'll jump right into it. So here's our episode with the St. Louis Zoo.
My name is Dominique Montgomery. I'm the Director of Safety and Risk Management at the St. Louis Zoo. And usually when folks hear that I work at the zoo, they ask me, "Oh, that's so cool. What animal do you work with?" And they're like utterly devastated when I tell them that I work with the humans. The cool thing about working in safety is that it touches all departments. So that means I get to visit all the different animal spaces, spend time with our animal care staff, and then you never know what's next. I may be headed up to facilities management to check in with the welders or the painters or something similar.
If you could give us a little bit of context and overview of the St. Louis view, you know, the size, number of employees, visitors, an overview of what this landscape looks like.
Our campus here in Forest Park is about 94 acres. We also have what we lovingly call the ZES, or the Zoo Expansion Site, which is just across Interstate 64. That puts us up to about 106 acres.
As far as some of the more unique attractions, is there anything specific that would be unique to the zoo that you had to think about as far as safety, you know, public, animal, what barriers, just kind of where do you start and how do you implement something like that?
That's a really great question. The good news is that we have really talented architects and designers that really bring a lot of those ideas already for us to take a look at. Some of the things that I may be called on to specifically answer to could be playgrounds, especially for kiddos and other interactives, different attractions, like we have a carousel and a train. So considering how those types of activities may interface with the public, and then just general safety as well, right? Like, how many emergency exits do we have? How are we looking from a distance from a barrier to a public pathway? What type of material are we looking for on a public pathway? What's the maintenance like? And that's where the collaboration with other departments is really important as well.
Just walking around and seeing everything that's here, and like you said, how large it is, this is a question I'm sure you get, and it's probably not easy to answer. Like, what does a day look like?
So that is probably my least favorite question, because it is so hard to answer. As any safety professional would tell you, no day is the same, and every day is a new adventure. Sometimes it feels like it's Groundhog Day. But the last couple years have also been super interesting for me, specifically just with the pandemic and working at a zoological institution, specifically when we're looking at zoonotic disease risks. And so the last couple years have been really interesting, focusing on the pandemic, reopening safely, keeping our staff and our guests safe, specifically keeping our animal care crew safe so that they can also care for the animals in our care.
You have to plan for some unexpected situations that others wouldn't have to prepare for. Could you give us an example of what something like that might be and how you plan for it?
I think probably like the most obvious thing is an escaped animal. That is probably the most interesting thing, right? That other organizations or other folks in the safety industry may not be planning for, because we do have animals in our care here. The good news is that we have a really, really talented animal care team, and they are the experts when it comes to recapturing that animal and how best to respond, specifically with recall training or familiarity with a specific keeper, etc. So there's a lot of planning that goes into that. And it's definitely a joint effort between animal care, safety, and security.
There's a lot of inclement weather, and you have a lot of people coming through. You have staff working here. What kind of measures do you have to put in place? Or could you share a few that you've had to implement when thinking about that and covering such a large area?
It's a large campus, and so especially when we're open to the public, coupled with the amount of staff that we have on grounds and the animals in our care, responding to a severe weather situation can certainly be challenging. Some of the items that we have to consider are communication, how to get that message out to all of the folks that we have on campus, all, you know, 94 acres of it just here at Zoo Campus, and then how that weather might also be impacting our other two campuses that are much further away from us. Some items that we've had to talk about that did not necessarily seem obvious to me when I first started were, hey, you don't have to secure your cash drawer if the weather is impending and you need to go take cover now. So there was a lot of concerns about, well, I have to secure my cash register before I can go and take cover in the building across the pathway here, because we have a lot of folks that work in outdoor stands and don't have access to a storm shelter. Other situations, how do I keep staff who maybe don't have a radio or haven't received the alert safe in the event that we need to take cover in a severe weather situation? So we've had to formulate a lot of different communication aspects. So we have an emergency notification system, like most institutions and organizations do. We do have a PA system. That's not something we typically use in a severe weather situation. And we have Cisco phones, so those are our voice over IP phones, or our VoIP phones that we also send notifications out over. And then of course the radio. The radio is probably the most direct way that we're able to share communication out. One of the larger challenges is that not everyone carries a radio, and if they do carry it, it's turned off.
Oh yeah, that would be challenging.
It's not great, especially, you know, you've turned your radio down because you're in a meeting or because you want to have a conversation with a guest or someone else, and you forget to turn it back up. When we're open to the public and we are seeking shelter in the event of severe weather, once we receive the all clear, it's mass chaos as everyone's exiting. But a larger component there is when guests may not want to shelter in place, they're ready to get to their car. And so we don't force them to stay, but certainly there is, you know, a risk there if security, animal care, and our grounds crew have not been able to clear grounds. It makes it difficult to really understand, are our barriers safe? Do we have a tree down in a habitat that could lead to a potential escape? are all of the animals in our care accounted for? We've been pretty lucky from that standpoint and haven't had to deal with an animal out from that perspective recently. We've certainly had trees down, but the good news is that we are a little city within the city, so our FN team responds and takes care of that very quickly.
Do you just block off that area and still let people in?
So the animals would obviously be recalled inside into their indoor habitat. And then yes, we would be blocking off that space or that pathway, whatever creates the safest environment while still allowing guest traffic to flow.
So is that part of your responsibility is coming up with, you know, how do we set up the barrier? How far do people need to, you know, be from the barrier, things like that?
It's definitely a team effort. In most situations, I do not have to get directly involved in that because our folks have a really good understanding. It is a very, very collaborative effort to work in safety in a zoological institution because there is no one expert in any specific response, specifically related to like animal care. So that is just such a collaborative response effort there when we're planning for those types of situations.
Is there a particular thing when you started this position that you were like, oh wow, I had really never thought of this before?
Oh man, I think the public is really a huge item that I had not really considered. Sure that they're there, and I worked in retail grocery before I came here, so certainly understood, you know, the general liability risk there, but it's different in, you know, a zoological setting, a park setting, an outdoor recreation setting. The folks don't always read signs, they're not respecting barriers, and it can be a real challenge to keep them safe.
I'm not sure if the audience knows, but the St. Louis Zoo is free to
the
public.
We are free, yes! The fact that the St. Louis Zoo is free is probably one of the most amazing things about our institution. We are free, but we are still one of the best zoos in the country because you can look on any, you know, any sort of report survey, and we are listed as one of the top institutions. There's a handful of free zoos across the United States, and we're really proud to be one of them.
It's truly gorgeous. These are fabulous job here. It's just beautiful.
As Dominique shared more about her job responsibilities, I found myself curious to learn more about her role with the animal exhibits. It had me thinking. Many of the animals within the zoo are powerful predators that could harm visitors if the animal habitats are not safe. So, how do they decide the best way to build a safe and secure habitat? It's not something you would think of as a regular zoo visitor, but since I had this time with Dominique, I wanted to find out.
There's different animal closures, there's barriers. Are you part of, you know, that planning process and figuring out how far the barriers need to be or how high the barriers need to be?
So that's a really great question, and I wish I could take sole credit for that, but I cannot. So again, the AZA, our accrediting body, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, really sets a lot of those standards for all zoos who are accredited by the AZA that they have to maintain certain barrier heights. And that's also true for USDA as well. Since we have animals in our care, we also need to meet USDA guidelines as well. When it comes to planning for different exhibits, earlier we passed by primate canopy trails where some of the primates are in open air habitats with mesh barriers, of course. But there is a certain distance that we want to ensure that visitors, guests are from those habitat barriers, and that's about 6 to 10 feet.
To show us an example of some of the decisions the zoo teams made for specific habitat, Dominique walked us to the orangutan exhibit. When we arrived, she pointed to some of the modifications that were necessary to ensure the space was safe, not just for the orangs, as she affectionately calls them, but for the visitors as well.
So this is our orang habitat, and you can see that it's open to the elements, and we've got a mesh in a mesh exterior there over the top of it from a containment standpoint. But what we found is that because it is open to the outdoors, we were seeing a lot of erosion and a lot of slips for animal care staff that were servicing the outdoor habitat for the orangs. And so what we wanted to do was address the safety concerns for the humans while also being mindful that this is still the orangutan's home. So what we did was come up with a plan to marry human safety and then animal safety all at one time. So this was a huge collaborative effort. We did put in concrete stair steps. We did put in vine. Our special construction team sort of fabricated these over different fire hose and other handholds that we put inside the habitat for different handholds for the keeper staff. And we also find that sometimes the orangutans use it too, which is great. And we have some more traditional handholds too. So we've got a railing that we installed as well, but it does withstand the strength of the animals that use the space as their home. So this is a really great example of ensuring that we have human safety top notch, but we're not impacting the animals' care. We have a really exciting chimp overlook wall. It's clear plexiglass material so that little kiddos or wheelchair users, other folks that may be short like myself, may have a better view of the animals in the habitat. But what we were finding and what we were hearing about were different animal incidents where humans may be finding their way into different habitats. And so what we wanted to do was still create a really great environment that allowed for our guests to safely view different animals on habitat. So in some of our different areas, we installed this, what we call invisible mesh. So it really doesn't impact the view of the habitat or the animals that may be using the habitat, but it still is keeping our guests and our staff safe. So one good example, again, is our chimp overlook. So we've got invisible mesh barrier that marries up to that glass barrier there, so that way no one's finding themselves over the barrier. We're not looking at cell phones in the moat, shoes, or anything like that, which sometimes is also an issue because we certainly do not want to give them any tools to utilize. Our vice president of architecture and planning found this mesh, and we've used it in like our orangutan habitat and whatnot as well. And so it really does not impact the view and still allows for a really great guest experience. And part of that great guest experience is keeping our guests safe and then the animals in our care safe too. So what we don't want is an incident that could have been prevented if we had appropriate barriers.
Zoos are a unique environment. There's an interesting mix of public safety, animal welfare, employee training, and many other factors that Dominique has to keep in mind. I imagine there aren't many EHS roles at zoos across the country, so I wanted to ask her where she turns for support or to get her questions answered.
The AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, has different committees that they run and support as part of the overall AZA organization. One of those committees is the AZA Safety Committee. So in October of 2023, I was finally selected to be part of the AZA Safety Committee. I was really, really excited to finally be selected to be part of this committee to better understand some of the emphasis areas that AZA puts on safety. It's a wonderful group of folks from different institutions all over the country that really are all dedicated and focused to safety in the zoological field. Later last year, and I guess earlier this year in 2024, I was asked to lead the mental health subcommittee, which is a newly formed subcommittee underneath the AZA Safety Committee. So that was a real honor, and I was really excited to be asked to co-lead that. And it's really looking at decreasing the risks of injury and illness at work, and then also in your environment at home. So we're looking at that person as a complete individual, and we understand that in most situations, folks can't check their baggage at the door, right? So they're probably bringing work home, and they're probably bringing home to work. So understanding that folks have a lot of different things impacting them, it helps us better approach safety from a holistic standpoint. One of the biggest things is burnout and compassion fatigue in our animal care staff. And that is an area that there's not a lot of data. We have a lot of data for like veterinarians and like traditional practices, you know, with domestic animals, but we don't really have a lot in the zoological field. Recently, the Denver Zoo and Colorado State University conducted a research study on compassion fatigue and burnout in animal care workers and zoo staff. So what we see is that animal care staff, veterinarians, vet techs, vet nurses, those folks are really dealing with a high level of compassion fatigue and burnout.
Dominique used a phrase that caught my attention, compassion fatigue. It's not a term I hear often in many of the industries within EHS, So I asked Dominique if she could explain the meaning further.
But can you imagine caring for 20 to 50 animals and caring for them every single day that you are here at work, and you've been here 5 years, 9 years, 15, 40 years, and then having to say goodbye a lot. There's only so much resiliency, and I hate that word now, and there's only so much coping mechanisms and like self-care that you can employ before it really gets hard. You know, at first during the pandemic, it started out as burnout. So we were working on split teams, and you know, they were working really long hours. But as the pandemic lulled on and on and on, we were seeing more and more compassion fatigue. Our folks were exhausted. They were caring for animals here in split teams. They were going home caring for family members, especially some of our sandwich generation, dealing with young kiddos, older parents and guardians, always being on in some capacity. And you know, they were exhausted. They are exhausted. And the industry is changing. We have to change to make sure that we are retaining our staff and keeping them safe.
I had not thought about the impact of, and a lot of times they have a shorter lifespan also. Yeah. So it's, like you said, happening more frequently.
A lot of the animals that we have are geriatric. So, I mean, not all of them, certainly, but, you know, our elephant herd, you know, some of our primates, our apes, you know, like we've got our hoof stock. We just have, like, that's just kind of how the cookie crumbled. We have, you know, a more geriatric population. And so over the last 5 years or so, you know, it's been tough on our animal care staff, and they're phenomenal and amazing. And, you know, they can do all the hard things, but sometimes that stuff is too hard. And, you know, how do we support them?
In your time here, evolve the more focus on that mental health piece?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So yes, and I'm gonna be kind of braggy about this because it was an important topic to me in 2017, 2018. I was realizing that we were focusing on mostly physical safety, but we were seeing a lot of mental health related issues compact safety. And so from that perspective, that's really when I tried to really hammer home this total worker health approach and really focus on, we've got to look at safety from a public health lens. We are looking at safety from a mental well-being standpoint, a physical standpoint, and a psychological safety standpoint. So when I started in 2015, the zoo had already started rolling out their three keys and their new values, which was wonderful. And they were really well received. So then we really needed to, you know, make sure that from the top down and bottom up, everyone was walking the walk, right? And with that came openness, communication, integrity. So we are sharing information when we get it. We are creating a space where folks feel comfortable bringing up their concerns and asking questions, asking for clarity. And so yes, in the last 9 years here at the St. Louis Zoo, there has been a shift in how we approach safety and how we approach employee health and wellness in general. We do also have really a phenomenal relationship between safety, HR, and DEAI. And I think that that's really an important way to tackle lots of staff issues. Certainly if someone comes to me with something and I'm like, ooh, I can't, like, I have to take this to someone else. You know, it's telling them, hey, I'm gonna keep this as confidential as I can, but I can't help you with this. I have to take this up to someone else. But creating that environment of trust so that they realize, hey, Dominique's doing this and helping me because she wants to get this tackled for me. So if I have to hand it off because it's not my lane, I'm doing it.
You know, that's interesting you brought up with HR as well. Is that an area that you've seen kind of transition?
I've been pretty lucky in that I've always had a great relationship with our HR team. When I first started at the St. Louis Zoo, I actually reported to the director of security, which was a very interesting relationship and super, super eye-opening. I learned a lot, but I was promoted quickly-ish, I guess, and found myself reporting directly to the vice president of internal relations. It has been that relationship between HR, safety, and security, if I'm being honest, and our DEAI director that has really, really shaped how the zoo approaches safety in general. The relationship between safety and HR, in my opinion, is super important to a positive outcome to either managing safety issues, HR issues, issues that don't really maybe belong in one specific category, but kind of touch a lot of different things. And it really is empowering, and it makes you feel good to be part of such a great team. DEAI is Diversity, Equity, Accessibility, and Inclusion. This was a newly approved position at the St. Louis Zoo within the last 24-ish months. We've always had a DEAI committee, and I co-lead workplace belonging with actually our director of HR, so it's a really great effort. But we do now have a director of DEAI who oversees all the DEAI things and then oversees our four different subcommittees with our goals and our action items, et cetera. But there's a huge marriage between DEAI and safety, right? Like, we've got the traditional DEAI things like PPE for women. You know, you don't just shrink it and make it pink. It doesn't work that way. Also, I don't like pink. So Mary Claire loves pink. So she wears a pink safety vest, but mine is lime green. But from that perspective, there's a lot of different collaborative relationships between DEAI and safety, specifically in our institution. And it could be because Rory and I both have master's in public health degrees, so we really approach things from the same perspective.
Well, now I'm gonna shift the focus just a little bit and talk about you, right? Because you are a fascinating person and a joy to talk to. But I'm curious how you became a safety professional.
There was a time in my life when I was very young that I fancied myself a human doctor. So I went to school and I got a biology degree and I finished that. And I was like, man, whew, I don't think I can go to med school. I don't think I can do this. And so I took a year off, and my mom suggested public health because that gives me the tools and the knowledge to do all the things I wanted to do, but, you know, not interact with people as much. So I was like, what is public health? And so I'm reading about it and I'm doing all this research and I'm like, you know, this sounds great. So I went to SLU and I did my public health degree, my master's in public health, and it's a dual focus on environmental and occupational health and safety and biosecurity and disaster preparedness. And when I finished grad school, my first job was occupational health and safety in a corporate office for retail grocery. My master's degree has a little point, you know, on occupational health and safety. So I was like, okay, I can do this. I had a wonderful boss. Her name's Jen. She is still a friend and mentor today. And I am definitely the safety lady I am today because of her. But a previous internship preceptor called me and said, hey, there's this job opening at the zoo. I really think you'd be a good fit for it. Why don't you apply? So I applied, and the rest is history. The zoo is the perfect place for me. Found that I was uniquely qualified from the biology degree, the public health degree, specifically with occupational health and safety, biosecurity and disaster preparedness. And then we have an old campus. So the environmental health component was really handy when we get into lead paint, asbestos, because some of our historic buildings.
You know, you said you worked in retail before. Sometimes people often say coming into a new position and developing that safety culture can be really challenging. Did you experience any of that, or how have you dealt with that?
It was a while that I was still sort of the new person. Lots of who did you know to get hired here questions. And it was definitely a lot of hard work building trust and, you know, building relationships across different departments and, you know, with individuals across campus. It was definitely a challenge to come in as the newbie, especially with a position that had been vacant for a while, especially into a team of one. So there was no one for me to really go to necessarily for, you know, questions related specifically to the organization. Of course, there were people across campus that I, you know, asked questions with and went to for help, but certainly, you know, there's always a background story that I feel that is probably there that would be helpful information to have. But it took a while to really build relationships with folks across campus. When I started, I was young. I looked a lot younger because I didn't have a child.
You still look very young,
thank
actually.
You. But it was definitely, you know, like, I've been doing this longer than I've been alive. I'll do that if you smile. And, you know, all of those different things. I am a young person in safety. I am a woman in safety. And so those were definitely challenges in general that I had to overcome, and that other people have to overcome too, right? It's not that I'm necessarily unique in that, but it's definitely still a very male-dominated field. Building those relationships with them took a lot of time, especially when literally, like, they're looking down on me, not just, you know, figuratively, but also they're a lot bigger than I am. I'm not a very big person. And so finding a way to connect with them and really, you know, let them know, hey, I'm here for you, for your best interest. I do know what I'm talking about. And if I don't, I will ask you, because I want to make sure that we're doing this together. So storytelling, I found, was a really powerful way to connect with them. So it was really a way to build that connection with them and build that relationship so that I could work on building the trust and the respect both ways, so that we could make the relationship collaborative and productive. Because if it's not productive and it's not collaborative, then it's really hard to make any sort of change when it comes to culture and relationships and safety.
Is there anything in particular or that you would advise a young girl looking at, I might want to go into this industry, but I have some hesitation because I know there's some barriers. What could help me get into it and feel confident?
I would say first, find someone that you feel comfortable asking your questions to, whether that is an actual mentor or if it is your local ASSP chapter, a local union, their safety representative. Ask people who you trust to find resources for you, whether they're in the safety industry or not. They're going to be able to help you find somewhere to go. And when we think of young girls, I'm thinking high school plus, right? Because we're definitely trying to break into that age group to get those folks interested in the safety field. And so what I have found is that ASSP, AIHA, a lot of those organizations do a lot of volunteer work and outreach work in those settings to really spread the word about safety and what this industry entails, because it truly is a STEM field, and we are working hard to try to increase the amount of females, girls, women in the STEM field.
Are you seeing that shift?
There's a survey that went out through the National Safety Council, I believe, and it goes out every year, and they ask you a lot of different demographic questions, and we are seeing the needle tick on the amount of females in the safety field, and it's great. And that also has to do with, you know, the other end of the stick here, right? The aging workforce. So folks are aging out, they're retiring, which means we've got a gap to fill. And so more folks are stepping in.
So I have to ask about certification. One, what certifications do you hold? And two, how have you found certification to be helpful in your career?
I hold ASP and CSP.
Yes.
So actually the CSP is my most recent. I was definitely very nervous to sit for that one. I think I was more nervous to sit for that than I was for ASP. I think because I felt like I had more riding on it. You know, at this point I was married, I have a kiddo, like he knew I was going to take a test. And so I was like, oh gosh, I can't go pick him up from school and tell him I didn't pass. Like, I can't do that. So it was definitely really exciting to get both of them, of course, but certainly maybe the CSP just feel, you know, it's more recent, so it just feels more fresh. From a perspective of, like, how has that helped me in my career? It wasn't on my radar until I started working after grad school, and my boss, my first mentor, Jen, was telling me, hey, you know, I think you need some more safety specific training. And that was really great feedback because my master's was public health, so it was really broad and I had a lot of different knowledge that I was bringing, but maybe not so much on the OSHA respiratory standard. There was a lot of, you know, support and gentle prodding to really start thinking about sitting for the ASP. It really had folks take me a bit more seriously, right? I do have this credential. I am a qualified safety professional to really sit at the table and have these conversations. When I sat for the CSP, my boss knew I was doing that. He also knew that I had been trying to do it for a while, but the pandemic kind of ruined some of my plans to sit for it earlier. And I didn't have the time I felt personally to really study and dedicate to study time before I could sit for it and feel confident that I would pass. But now the team knows, you know, Dominie has this credential. She's got two of them. This is what it means. She's truly an expert in this field. You know that if she's giving you information, it is good information. And if she's telling you she doesn't know, then she's going to come back and find the answer. As we're real big on trust there, right? We're not making up answers. We're sharing information freely and properly, and we want to make sure that it's good.
Was there anything in particular that you found helpful in your study?
So I really liked the exam core.
Was it the online?
Yes.
The online version.
And I really also liked the assessment that you guys did that helped me identify what my opportunities were. That was really helpful. And I also spent a lot of time understanding what my opportunities were and where I need to focus on in those specific areas. And that's where the exam prep online was really helpful.
When you look at, when people look at their weaknesses and stuff, did you find it encouraging to learn about things you may not use necessarily?
I found that a lot of my opportunities were in areas that I did not necessarily spend a lot of my workday in because of the industry I'm in. So it was really helpful to A, identify those areas, and then B, learn all the things about it. It was really exciting, and that also helped me personally navigate to some of my safety contacts in the St. Louis WISH chapter of WISE through ASSP, who do work in some of those industries and were able to give me some actual real life technical knowledge. And that was really helpful. But I wouldn't have known that information if it hadn't been for the exam prep and the assessments.
Well, no, that's good to hear. I've heard that from several people. It just, how it expands your knowledge in areas you didn't realize.
No, it was really exciting, right? It's kind of like the tests that you take in like high school and college to tell you like, hey, this is what you're really good at. You should consider this career field versus like, maybe not so much, like probably not a math genius over here. So it was really helpful to have that information to really, dictate where I should spend the majority of my efforts for studying, because we're grown-ups and adults and we got things to do. So it was an efficient use of time.
What are some of the key skills you look for when you're going to hire a safety professional?
The key skills and, education components that I'm looking for are going to be pretty broad, just based on our industry and some of the different challenges that we have. But I'm looking for someone who's got education related to safety. So whether that's public health, occupational safety, or something similar. I'm looking for someone who's got experience in safety or risk management or both, because that's really important. And that can be volunteer experience, and that can be through a volunteer organization or real experience maybe that you had as an intern or something like that. I'm also looking for credentials. As a certified safety professional now, I understand the importance of what that credential means. But as someone who was entering the workforce who did not have that credential, I certainly understand that the ability to obtain it is also as equally as important as, coming into a job with that. Positions that I would typically be looking for are going to be a more entry or mid-level. So from that perspective, I'm looking for, different years of experience, really good communication, and really a self-starter and go-getter. I feel that different things can be learned and taught, but when we get to integrity, good communication, relationship building, all of that stuff is just, it's you. It's part of who you are. And those types of, character traits are really important when you're working in the safety field.
For an entry-level position, would you require a degree? And if so, does it have to be in a specific discipline?
At our organization in safety, you do need to have a four-year degree in safety-related fields. So occupational health and safety, public health, something similar. We're also really open to, a two-year degree with experience, two-year degree with credential, any number of combination of degree and years of experience. All of the safety folks that have worked here at the St. Louis Zoo have all had at minimum a bachelor's degree.
If people wanted to be a safety professional at a zoo, is it, pretty limited in the number of job opportunities?
So that's a good question. I feel there's a lot of, there's a good amount of AZA accredited zoos across the country, and even through WASA, which is the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums that is looking globally. And I think that It really depends on the size of the institution, you know, how many folks work there, size of animal collection, et cetera. I would definitely say that there is a decent amount of folks that work in safety in the AZA world. It is not typically a sought after field because a lot of folks don't realize it exists.
Right.
And so what, you know, ways to break into the AZA safety world would really just be looking at the AZA website and, you know, understanding what AZA accreditation means, what that means from an institution standpoint, animals in our care, the kind of individuals that work at AZA institutions, and then from there, understanding, you know, how to get involved in that organization. I don't have any good pro tips because the zoo job fell into my lap. I was super lucky to find this job, but I am learning more and more throughout my time in the zoo industry that the safety positions certainly are not as abundant as they might be in construction or manufacturing. But I'm also learning through leading WISH that there's a lot of safety to be had in non-traditional industries. For example, we have an ally member of our group who is the safety and security coordinator at Mid-America Transplant. It's literally organ transplant. It's just so fascinating to listen to some of the differing safety concerns that they have, but some of those concerns are similar, right? So they're also providers. We have providers, everyone, you know, their patients are human, our patients are animals, but we're still using similar medical equipment, scalpels, anesthesia, different things like that. So it's very fascinating, you know, to be out in the community and listen to industries that may seem so different and so unique, but sometimes still have a lot of the same challenges. The work that we do here is so important to me on a personal level that I really find myself fulfilled here in this institution when it comes to working in occupational health and safety, because I get to work with the most incredible team of folks, and then they get to go out and do boots on the ground work that really impacts conservation. We are repopulating extinct in the wild populations with animals in our care, and it's just really amazing to be part of that.
When you come here every day, are you thinking, okay, this is truly what's keeping me here? What is that?
I feel like it changes every day. The majority of the time, it's the people, because we just have an incredible sense of community here at our institution. But sometimes it's the fact that I don't really want to work on this policy today. So I'm going to go do some quote unquote inspections. And I'm going to go spend some time out on grounds viewing different animals that I take for granted that I can see every day of the week where other people may not. And then it's the mission, right? The work that we do to conserve wild places, wild things, educate people. I think at the end of the day, that coupled with the amazing group of people that work here at this institution are my why I stay here.
So that was our episode with the St. Louis Zoo. Again, it was such a different environment than other places that we visited. It was really eye-opening just to see behind the scenes what makes a place like the zoo work, and especially from an EHS standpoint. So, you know, I really enjoy just kind of seeing like how successful or well-run organizations work. And it was really interesting to see how Dominie and her team, how they impact so many other areas of the business. So that was really cool for me to see. Christy, what were some of your key takeaways?
Yeah, well, like you, Charlie, it was fascinating, and the zoo said such a well-kept business, and it's free, free to the public, which I thought was great. Some of the key takeaways that stood out to me are really first that it's clear the mission of the zoo is really what keeps Dominie dedicated and passionate about her work. That's really important to her, and you could tell. Also, the importance of mentorship can't be overstated. It's been vital for growth and support in roles like hers, especially when it comes to having a community of peers to learn from. And I'd say lastly, just building trust and credibility is essential when it comes to driving meaningful culture change. And this is really true for any organization. And it's something that we've seen time and again throughout our podcast series as really a fundamental driver for real lasting change. And that was definitely prevalent in our interview with Dominie.
Yeah, and we also had the chance to talk to some other people in other departments, and they just raved about the impact that Domini has had and having a certified safety professional on their team, how that's helped their business, helped them to think about all aspects of safety. So, yeah, that I think the way she was able to come in as in the beginning a one-person team and build that trust and credibility, and now her team is growing, and you can just see the positive impacts that she's making. So that was really great to see. You know, and this was just another look at what a safety professional does in a different environment. So we hope that everyone who listened had some good key takeaways like that. And if you are listening for the first time, just subscribe, like, follow us on social media. But we'll have more episodes coming to you in some other interesting industries. So please just stay tuned and be on the lookout for new episodes as they come out. So Christy, thanks again for the visit with the St. Louis Zoo and for just going on these trips and just learning more about who safety professionals are. I think this is great for the audience we have and for anyone. Just it's a good education. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Domini, and thanks to the St. Louis Zoo also for allowing us to come in and give us that great opportunity to see behind the scenes. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Safety on Location is a podcast from BCSP with your host, BCSP CEO, Christy Uden. Executive produced by Charlie Eltringham. Produced by Joel Burgai. Edited by Jared Griot. And editorial support from Brandon Mohawk. If you like this episode, subscribe to receive new episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.